This program is brought to you by the Genesis Communications Network, a world leader in talk radio since 1998. Visit GCNlive.com today.
Welcome back to the Paracast, the gold standard of paranormal radio. And now, here's Gene Steinberg.
Now, based on what I'm listening, correct me if I'm wrong, Mark Ollie, the references, written references to King Arthur, Merlin, etc., came about hundreds of years after he purportedly lived, correct?
Yes and no. Okay, the fact that they were written down at a particular time doesn't mean that the stories weren't in circulation. And you've also then got to consider that whatever the earliest, you know, written references are, if it's in the 800s and 900s, not only have those stories got to be important enough to have survived what happened in 542 AD, when you had this giant catastrophe, they've also then got to appeal to the culture that's writing them down. I mean, the Saxons hated him with a vengeance, so they didn't write a single word about him. They avoided him like the plague. But the Danes and the Vikings and subsequent invaders really liked him, so they actually took the trouble to start writing things down. But his fame, you know, his renown and the stories that were being told about him actually survived for a couple of hundred years, you know, before that they were written down, which is, you know, amazing. That's pretty incredible that he survived that long. And there are, like I say, these incidental references in the saints' lives and things which make you think people must have known what those stories were for them to make it into these saints' lives. You don't write about a person that's unknown, but it's mostly limited to Wales, and it's mostly written in archaic Welsh. So you're looking at something that's very monocultural at this point. So the process is almost, I mean, the last chapter of the book, The Legend, which is part five, just deals with the development of the written records, and it's a history in itself. People who say, oh, you know, there's absolutely nothing, you know, it's all medieval nonsense, they need to read that last section of the book. You know, don't be put off, because it is readable. It is a gigantic academic sort of, you know, list of important, significant books and that, but once you start getting into that section, then it really answers that question in a big way. That's what survived, you know, and that's how it developed. So you're right. I mean, probably in his lifetime, people didn't, you know, people who lived in North Wales, where he came from, probably thought, yeah, he wasn't bad. He was all right. You know, he did his job kind of thing. The Saxons, as I said, hated him and probably hadn't got the foggiest idea who it was that was giving him a serious ass-kicking. You know, they wouldn't really have appreciated him at all. And then the Vikings and Danes are coming in thinking, well, hang on a minute, we've got Beowulf, and we've got a few other heroes, you know, Holger the Dane and all this, that and the other. We've got all these amazing heroes. What are we going to do in Britain? Where's the British equivalent, you know? And fairly quickly, because the book deals with this as well, fairly quickly, when they were messing about in Wales, they picked up on this guy called Arthur. By the time Geoffrey Monmouth got hold of him, he was really well known. You know, there was Geoffrey wouldn't have bothered writing him into his history unless there was already material about him. There are carvings on churches, you know, in the 1000s in Italy and places like that. There's a giant mosaic in Otranto that has Arthur featured in carvings and tiles and things like that. That would not have happened, you know, 100 years before Geoffrey, unless this character was really strong and already known. And as I said, you know, there's this massive poem about this warrior, and right at the very end he gets this little bit of a slagging off, you know. Yeah, he was great, but by hell, he was no Arthur, you know. Doesn't really, you know, doesn't compare, you know. So things like that make it an interesting book, because you are getting the truth, you know. This is what we have, and this is where it's come from. I think I'm the first person, really, to... I'd like to blow my own trumpet and say nail it, but I'm sure people will find bits that I missed and things like that. But I have to say, I have been at it 45 years. It's taken 45 years to get the book into print and written and finished. I started it in 1977 when I worked on a film, a Super 8mm film for a film society back then, and I sort of got the bug. So, you know, it's took me a while to do it. But don't be put off. It's not as big and bad and ugly as it looks. And if you want to order it, get the hardback, because I'm just looking at my copy now. It's really sexy in hardback. It's just really nice. There you go. How have you managed to segue into an advert?
You managed to segue into an ad for the book.
This is probably a stupid question, but is Arthur the actual name, or has it been modernized? I mean, back in his day and in whatever language that they were speaking at the time, would they have been saying Arthur?
Actually, that's a brilliant question. Okay, I'm going to hats off to you for that one, because that is a really, really good question. All the other knights, all of them, have got Welsh names that don't match what we're used to. So, for example, Gwaine is known as Walwen. Guinevere is unpronounceable. I can't even... Winlergy is the equivalent, you know. So... No, actually, he stayed as Arthur. Because it's a Roman name, he wasn't the first Arthur, by the way. There's quite a few of them before him. Goes all the way back to the first century AD. He wasn't the first. So this name became sort of enshrined, if you like, as a sort of a Latin hero. And it's always been Arthur, no matter what. So all the other variants you get, I mean, these people have tried to be really clever in modern times and say, oh, it's Arthwis, Arknu, Arturus, Arturius, anything with ART at the beginning. And they're like, oh, yeah, that's it. It's got to be Arthur. No, absolutely not. What I found was that without doubt, every single time, his name is Arthur, because the name is really important. He's named after a hero. He's named after some prominent line, if you like, of warrior heroes that the Romans were aware of. And he's always called Arthur. And there's a couple of people as well, heroic people after him. They were still calling people Arthur right into the Saxon period. In fact, I'm going to blow your mind now, there was a prophecy. I think it was Merlin made a prophecy and said that, in Britain's greatest hour of need, King Arthur will return. So, I mean, that tells you it was a later prophecy. And currently we're about to put Charles III on the throne. I think his coronation is set for May, and one of his middle names is Arthur. So, yeah, that was an extremely good question. The name is crucially important. It is. Although, you can only guess at what it means. In Welsh, it's derived from the word for bear. So that's made people think that he was a big, big, strong, strapping, hairy bloke. But I'm not sure I'd go down that route. I do mention it in the book, but...
Now, clarify this to me. I'm trying to understand something here. Clarify this for me. So is Arthur not one person, but... a group of people or a title, just like Merlin is?
Arthur himself, who we're looking at, is Arthur of the Britons. Okay, that's him. And he lived at a very specific period of time, indeed. So he has a birth date, etc. Hang on, just check this. Sure I get it right. I know he dies in 539, but the Welsh have got a birth date, 483. He's born in 483 AD and he dies in 539. And that is the bloke. That is the guy we're talking about. That having been said, there were people before him who carried the name Arthur. And there were people after him that carried the name Arthur. So it's a bit like, you get these famous footballers, that are, have different names than that. And then all of a sudden all the kids in that year end up, being named the same. I'm thinking of David Beckham, in that particular year, there were that many Davids, people christened as David. It was ridiculous. And basically, that's where Arthur's name comes from. His parents gave him that name because it was a really good, special, privileged, heroic Roman name with a great pedigree. So it's like, yeah, go on, we'll name him that. But it's Arthur the Briton specifically that we're looking at. So no other name other than Arthur. In no other period of time is this particular guy. He's got to be there at the end of the 5th century and the beginning of the 6th century. That's who you're looking for. I take great pains in the book to say that is the guy you're looking for. Because there are other people out there with the name Arthur, but it's just not him. So hopefully that answers your question.
We've got a question from one of our listeners, Richard Hawkins, who always comes up with some of the best questions.
Good.
And he wants to know, can you talk about what is myth, what is legend about King Arthur? And he also asks, did the Merlin character really exist? And we've already, talked about that. But, what about King Arthur? I mean, And we're going to be going to a break in a little bit, so I guess Gene will have to make this one a cliffhanger. But what is the truth and what is the fiction about King Arthur?
We'll hang on the cliff with Tim and Gene and Mark, you're in
the Paracast.
Hey, listeners. I want you to have the entire Paracast experience. So I'd like to tell you about After the Paracast. After the Paracast is an exclusive feature for subscribers to the Paracast Plus. With After the Paracast, you never know what's going to happen next. After the Paracast features color commentary, special interviews, and further conversations with Paracast guests. With Paracast Plus, you can download a very special enhanced version of the Paracast also. We do offer exclusive music, videos, and more features are coming. To get more info about subscribing, please visit theparacast.plus. Once again, theparacast.plus. Prices are just $1.50 a week, less than a cup of coffee at your local convenience store. Check out theparacast.plus to learn more about Paracast Plus.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joel Wallach, the Dead Doctors Don't Lie guy. There's no reason why you shouldn't live to be at least 100 and have a great time getting there. And I'm going to give you a free copy of my lecture that tells you exactly how to do it. In fact, after you've lived a long and healthy life, there should be only two documents in your medical chart, a birth certificate and a death certificate. I'm Dr. Wallach with a warning. If you have a 4-inch medical chart, if you take prescription drugs for high cholesterol, high blood pressure, arthritis, joint pains, and other health issues, the medical profession is failing you. They're using you for an ATM machine. My free lecture is going to reveal what pharmaceutical companies don't want you to know. There's been groundbreaking research and discoveries on how to effectively treat or eliminate over 900 different diseases naturally, and it's all in my free lecture called Deadly Recipe. So call toll-free 1-855-79-YOUNG. Again, that's toll-free 1-855-79-YOUNG. 1-855-79-YOUNG.
A lot can happen in 6 seconds. A rodeo ride, a dramatic basketball win, and the world record holder can solve a Rubik's Cube. 6 seconds is how long it takes for an 18-wheeler traveling at a safe speed to come to a complete stop. And in those 6 seconds, that truck will travel the length of 2 football fields. So please, give them room. Never cut in front of a large truck for any reason. Our roads, our responsibility. Learn more at sharetheroadsafely.gov.
Get healthy, not high, with 100% pure CBD powerful natural pain relief from Veterans Vitality. GCN listeners, have you ever thought about how CBD may help you? I'm sure you have heard about the many benefits of CBD. Well, here's your opportunity to try before you buy. Created by veterans and for everyone who deserves better choices, our CBD is derived from organic hemp, grown in the USA, and third-party tested. Veterans Vitality CBD saves you as much as 25 to 50% over our competition, and a portion of all sales is contributed to veteran nonprofits and events. Many of our customers have experienced improved quality of life, help with anxiety, PTSD, and overall well-being. Our products do not contain THC. They are safe, non-addictive, effective, and 100% legal. GCN listeners, get your free trial bottle of premium CBD by simply paying shipping and handling at GCNFreeCBD.com. That's GCNFreeCBD.com. Again, GCNFreeCBD.com. Offered by Veterans Vitality Premium CBD.
Frustrated trying to get business capital? Want to take the slow process and rejection out of the equation? GCNLoans.com removes the slow, irritating approval process. Instead, get quick, simple funding. Powered by David Allen Capital, 80% of our pre-qualified clients are approved in days. Pre-qualify at GCNLoans.com and get your money this week. It's that easy. GCNLoans.com. That's GCNLoans.com.
We'd like to hear from you. If you have a comment or question about the Paracast, send it to news@theparacast.com. That's news@theparacast.com. And don't forget to visit our famous Paracast community forums at forum.theparacast.com.
I was thinking there that we'd hear the best British accent that Tim Swartz can provide. And he can't engage.
I don't want Mark to think that I'm making fun of him, you know.
Oh, gosh, I've got to say here, I live right in the middle, literally in the middle of Liverpool and Manchester.
Oh,
so,
I love that.
So you can imagine, you've got the Scouse accent for Liverpool and you've got the Manc accent for Manchester, and I'm bang in the middle. So how on earth I've managed to survive this long without some strange, weird, hybrid pronounced accent, I really don't know. So no, you couldn't possibly compare to what I live with on a daily basis up here. No, my accent's quite acceptable compared to most. If you want Scouse, think of the Beatles, but then some. Yeah, to answer the question, to get back to that, the difference between myth and reality. Okay, I suppose the answer to that really is in the method. Once you know when this particular Arthur is alive, so you know that he's coming out at the end of the Roman period, he's alive at the end of the 5th century, going into the beginning of the 6th century, then there's a certain number of things that he just couldn't have done, and he couldn't have owned, you know, he couldn't have been that way, because at that point in time, they didn't exist. And there is a certain number of things that he could have done, you know, there is a likelihood that he would have been familiar with certain things based on when he lived, which is why that date is so important. So the simplest possible answer, if you know your history, you know your archaeology, I'm an archaeologist by profession, you know, so I dig through layers and my specialism is to know where things sit in time. So that's assisted me in putting the book together. You know, that will then tell you really, in a nutshell, what is myth and what isn't. That kind of answers the question. There is a kind of a secondary proviso on that for the benefit of the listeners. And the other thing that might help you in deciding is have a look at where the source material is. So the geography plays a part in this. So if you're looking at a tale that's essentially based on Wales, or it's coming out of Wales, or it's from the Welsh records, or it dates back to medieval times where they've gone to records which are stored in Wales or in the Old North, the north of England. If you're looking at something like that, then chances are you're looking at something that has a grain of truth in it somewhere. But as soon as it's pulled out of that context and you start looking at, you know, what was written by the Normans, written in London, written all around the world, etc., people who are unfamiliar with the background information at that time tend to fill in the blanks. You know, they tend to make stuff up. Somebody even accused Geoffrey of Monmouth of making a heap of all the information and inventing what he didn't know. And they made that accusation in something like 1125 AD, when he'd only just written it. You know, so I'm not saying anything out of order here. It's something that scholars have known for a long, long time. People did tend to embroider things a bit. But what I said earlier on in the interview about people having to stick to the original basic story, that was still true right up to the time of Geoffrey. Because if you didn't, you know, it's like, you know, if you have a major star nowadays and a major brand, you know, that's familiar to the viewers or the listeners in this case, you can only mess with that brand so much before it's no longer acceptable, before it's no longer accepted, it's no longer believed. So I hope that really answers it. So, yeah, it's down to when he lived, so that makes whatever's possible possible. It's down to where he lived, which makes kind of sense of whether or not you've got the authentic legend or not. And then I suppose, as just as a bolt-on, as a proviso to that, you know, you've just got to be careful with the original material. You've got to kind of understand, you know, what has survived and, you know, what's out there to build on, what the foundations are. So I suppose this book, you know, Geoffrey of Monmouth, 1,000 years ago, you know, back in the 1100s, he put out his, you know, History of the Kings of Britain, and that kind of set the tone then for the next 1,000 years, you know, of King Arthur legends. I'm kind of secretly hoping the Polychronicon does the same thing, you know. Here we are in 2023, and I'm hoping people will read this and go, oh, hang on a minute, hey up, you know, and take it from here, you know, go from here and see what they make of it. It's kind of a new Polychronicon for a new age in that sense, very much for now. And we seem very keen on finding out what the truth is at the moment. You know, there's this real digging into what is true and what is false. So, it's a book of its time, as indeed a lot of the other Arthur books in the past have been. I hope that answers the question anyway.
Oh, yeah, that was yeah. Great. The title of your book, you've got Arthur, Joseph, and Merlin. So now, What does Joseph of Arimathea have to do with all this?
Oh, right, okay. It's a bit of an odd one, when you first look at it, because everyone knows who Merlin is, everybody knows who Arthur is, but then you've got this thing where you've got the Grail, you know, the Holy Grail, and people start to look at that, and that is eternally associated with Arthur, you know, everything from the early legends right through to Monty Python, you know, and all that. It's Arthur. So you've got to look at the Grail. When you look at the Grail, it starts with the biblical legends. It starts in Bible times, and the first person really to get to grips with anything that we would call a Grail is Joseph of Arimathea. That's where it begins, and it's his story that brings the Grail, or Grails plural, out of the situation that they start in the upper room and at the crucifixion, because him and his associates had intimate contact with both the Last Supper and the crucifixion. So it's him and his immediate group that gather together the holy relics that Arthur and his knights later on then go on quests and searches for. The Grail, of course, is included in that. The trouble is, by the time you get to medieval times, the term Grail, or Sangreal, is a Viking term. Sang is the affirmative, the in capital letters. Graal is a Grail, it's derived from gruel, which is a form of bread porridge that's served in a stone bowl. So you're not just looking for any old porridge bowl, you're looking for the porridge bowl. Sangreal, the Grail, which of course ideally would be either the cup that Jesus used at the Last Supper, or it would be the cup of the disciples, which was the one he passed round. It's got to be one of those two. Both of those were known to have existed at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre right through Anglo-Saxon times, right through the days of Arthur. So clearly that's not the Grail Arthur's ultimately looking for at the time he lived, because they actually, those Grails end up going across to Spain. In 2012, somebody was doing some research over in the Middle East looking at Islamic records, and they actually found the shipping receipts for those two bowls, or certainly one of them, if not both of them, going from Jerusalem to Spain. So those cups are now currently in Spain. It's a long story. I know we haven't got loads of time to go into it, but that's where they've gone. The Grail that Joseph of Arimathea brought here, they were two glass Roman vials or cruets, one with the blood of Christ and one with the sweat of Christ. And when Joseph was buried here in North Wales, they were buried with him. So when you see that the knights are searching for the Grail, that's the Grail they're actually after.
Okay, so we know that it's not something that Harrison Ford and Sean Connery did for a movie. It's not located in some kind of chamber where you remove something from the chamber and the entire thing comes crashing down on you. Not going to happen here. Mark Coley, Gene Steinberg, Tim Swartz, you're in.
The Podcast.
You are listening to GCN. Visit GCNlive.com today.
Silver has always been nature's very own antibiotic, and only one system allows you to generate an endless supply of natural silver solutions, SilverLungs.com. You'll find no wild claims or pseudoscience, just a lifetime of nano-sized pure silver solutions. The Silver Lungs generator allows you to make your own, so stop paying for silver solutions. The unique lung delivery system targets respiratory infections where other silver solutions simply cannot reach. See the Silver Lungs generator and lung delivery system at SilverLungs.com. That's SilverLungs.com.
Are you afraid to go to the mailbox because of letter after letter from the IRS? Are they stacking on more and more penalties and interest? By now, you know the problem won't go away on its own. Don't let the IRS chase you to your grave with penalties and interest and liens and levies. You need real help now. I'm Dan Pilla. I wrote the book on tax debt settlement, and I help thousands of people solve tax problems they thought couldn't be solved. I can help you too. Call 800-34-NO-TAX or go to my website, danpilla.com. That's danpilla.com. Danpilla.com.
USA News Update. Former Vice President Mike Pence is not too happy about the prospect his former boss may be arrested on Tuesday in New York City.
The fact that the Manhattan DA thinks that indicting President Trump is his top priority, I think, is just tells you everything you need to know about the radical left in this country.
In an exclusive interview with ABC's This Week, Pence said it just feels like a politically charged prosecution. Two U.S. senators would like to see TV cameras in federal courtrooms and in the U.S. Supreme Court. Iowa Republican Chuck Grassley and Minnesota Democrat Amy Klobuchar are co-sponsors of the Sunshine in the Courtroom Act. They say allowing television coverage would give more transparency into the court system for the public. And it's not going to be a repeat national championship for the Kansas Jayhawks. The top-seeded team was eliminated in the men's NCAA basketball tournament in the second round on Saturday. John Schaefer, USA News.
Tahibo Tea Club's original Pure Pouty Arco Super Tea comes from the only tree in the world that fungus does not grow on. As a result, it naturally has antifungal, anti-infection, antiviral, antibacterial, anti-inflammation, and anti-parasite properties. So the tea is great for healthy people because it helps build the immune system, and it can truly be miraculous for someone fighting a potentially life-threatening disease due to an infection, diabetes, or cancer. The tea is also organic and naturally caffeine-free. A one-pound package of tea is $49.95, which includes shipping. To order, please visit shopsupertea.com. The first word is shop, spelled S-H-O-P, then the word super, and then the word tea. The complete website is shopsupertea.com or call us at 818-984-6100 Monday through Saturday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. California time. That's 818-984-6100. ShopSuperT.com.
I had no idea it would destroy my life. But before it happened, I had a successful business in Austin, Texas. Everyone laughed at me when I shut that business down, but I could not ignore the wake-up call. I was volunteering on a project to get locally grown food into a school. That project was a complete failure, and I discovered that there were few local farmers, there's only 4 days worth of food in the grocery stores, and everything comes 1,500 miles via a just-in-time trucking system. I lost friends and family who told me I was crazy to worry about that, but I kept at it. I'm Marjorie Wildcraft. Those of us who know what's going on in the world know you need to become self-reliant before the dollar collapses. I've created a free webinar at gcnfood.com. I can show you, like I've shown hundreds of thousands of people, how to grow lots of food, even if you have no experience, you're older, or you're out of shape. Do it now, before the stores are boarded up and food is not available at any price. Go to gcnfood.com. gcnfood.com.
This is Robert Hastings, author of UFOs and Nukes, and you're listening to the Paracast, the gold standard of paranormal radio.
I'm actually a huge fan of Steven Spielberg, so I've got to sort of say that yes and no. He did a fantastic job of his research, because that word Grail is applied to, in medieval times, any cup or any chalice that's used in communion. People didn't appreciate what communion was. They didn't read the Bible in medieval times because it wasn't available. So the stories were unique to people of certain religious orders, Templars being one of them. And I do cover this in the book as well, because I go on after the lifetime of Arthur in the book. So technically, any vessel that is consistently used for communion could be termed a grail. So I'm not going to go totally against what Spielberg did, and I really appreciate where he was coming from in the Indiana Jones movie. But it's not the grail, how can I put it? It's not the grail we're looking for. You know, it's not the one we're going after for the original Arthur, but it could be a grail. It's Agraal, not Sangraal. It's Agraal. So, yeah, it's possible. And it depends, again, then. I mean, you mentioned earlier spiritual beliefs. If you're into the bread and the wine actually being, you know, the body and blood of Christ, that goes way back. I mean, it goes all the way back to Abraham in the Old Testament. So you're going way, way back. This idea of alcoholic fluid of some kind and a grain-based substance in a container that sustains you. I mean, that goes, archaeologically, that goes all the way back to Neolithic times, because prehistory. Because that's what we find from pottery analysis. So it goes back a hell of a long way. If you go with a spiritual view, you know, that actually now has been appropriated for, you know, the blood and body of Christ, then you have a belief there. that was really coming into its own. It was beginning to establish itself around about the time of Arthur. Because as well as the Druids, of course, we also had the Christians. So I tend to cover that in the book. So now we're back full circle. We're back to why Joseph and the biblical material is so important. It's the material Arthur would have been aware of at the time. He sat there, you know, it's whatever it is, old Christmas Day, I think 16th of January, the Celtic Christmas. He sat there at his table, which probably was round, you know, and he's got this vision for sending his knights out to find the Grail. What I do is I give you the reason why he's got that information, the geography, who it is that brought that to this part of the world and why it involves him, you know, and that's the Joseph of Arimathea bit. So anybody that's into the Grail, that's the Joseph bit on the cover. And the Grail is a substantial issue. You know, like I say, I think I've got about 27 variations of the Grail in the book, and there's probably a lot more that I've missed. But there's some really nice ones in there and some really unusual ones.
Well, I mean, I've seen some fascinating pictures of cups, grails, that have been discovered over the years that have been speculated to be the Grail. Some of them, you know, gold and encrusted with jewels, which I think would be unlikely. Then there was a small one that came up rather recently, not the wooden one, but one that was made out of, I think, a precious crystal or something like that, which almost kind of fits the description of you said, Roman glass. But I would think that glass would be fragile, and that by now it's just a million little pieces scattered across the countryside.
It's not something you can really apply logic to. In the book, I say that literally the Grail, Sangreal, you know, it could have been anything. It could have been clay, glass, stone, wood, you know, pretty much anything that was available could have qualified as Sangreal, the Grail, in that sense, because it's whatever was available for the Last Supper. You know, I don't know quite what they use for that dinner service. But the one that's jewel-encrusted, that actually, I think it's the, what's it called now? I'm trying to remember. I'm going to see if I can look it up really quickly. Sacro Cantina. Anyway, it's the one in Spain. I'm not going to beat about the bush. It's the Spanish one. Basically, you've got a Roman agate cup. Because they were quite expensive because they were made of stone. So it's not a cheap thing. You've got one of these agate cups. And what they've basically done is they've mounted it on a base to turn it into a sort of medieval chalice. But that's not what it would originally have looked like. And they've been able, through the wonders of archaeology, to separate this stone cup and have a look at that just on its own. And they actually do think it's first century Roman. And the funny thing is, there were two of these that disappeared, as I said, from the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And in Spain, lo and behold, there are two of them. And they're both the same. They're these alabaster cups. The kicker in these receipts is, though, that when it was sent over during the times of the Crusades, Saladin got wind of it, and he asked, could they take a little cutting, a little chip off the rim, because his daughter was ill, and he wanted this thing to be sent to him, this chip of the holy cup, to cure his daughter. And lo and behold, one of these cups has a chip out of the lip. It's the holy chalice of San Isidoro. San Isidoro is the one I'm referring to. That's the main one. But there's another one, the holy chalice of Valencia, is the other agate one. And chances are they're actually both correct. I'm not going to say which is which, but and there are others. There are others. So, you know, the mystery is still there. Did I get a flash then for another question?
Oh, there's always questions. Lots of questions. So Arthur then lived in a very interesting time in the history of Britain. Okay, so you say that he lived approximately, you know, like, what would it be, 5th century?
Yeah, it's either side of 500 AD.
Yeah, so, I mean, you've got this interesting mixture of old paganism going on, Druidism, things like that, and then you've got Christianity as it was in that early period, making its inroads into Great Britain. So, you know, I mean, what Because, you know, once again, I mean, you know, you've got all of these stories that, you know, basically came out in the Victorian era, which is very Christian-based. But what would it have been like for Arthur at that time?
Well, wow, you talk about a turning point for Arthur. I mean, the time he lived in was a turning point for the entire world. What was happening at that point in time? Basically, Christianity had existed since the first century. Obviously, it had spread across the face of the planet, and Constantine the Great eventually made it possible to be a Christian without being persecuted. But what had happened by that point, by the 300s, 400s AD, is you basically had three churches. You had the one based in Jerusalem that was based on Egyptian and Jewish material. You had one based in Rome, which was based on Mithraic and Roman material. But you had one over here, founded by Joseph of Arimathea, the oldest Christian church in the world, somewhere between 52 and 54 AD, that was based on Celtic Druidic material. So they had a different type of church. And you can actually see this argument breaking out between this country and Rome. It's like just a huge bust-up that takes place just before Arthur comes to prominence. So, you know, that's world-beating, world-changing. And what most people don't realise is that actually they think that the mother of the first non-apostolic pope, so it's Pope Linus, I think you're going back to the, whatever it is, the 70s AD, the mother was British. So there's a lot of connections in Christianity that come back here that made us incredibly powerful. And they're based up here in the north, because that's where Joseph was. So you've got this thing where the old north has claim to those, the early Christians and the first Christian martyrs. You've also then got this idea that Rome is collapsing. I mean, that was no small event. You know, the Visigoths attacked Rome. The last king, Theodoric, sent to Britain for reinforcements. And that's possibly the reason in later life why Arthur then sets off for the continent to fight for Theodoric. Now, the thing is, he loses, and you end up with Goths ruling Rome. So it's the end of the Roman Empire completely. So that's pretty earth-shattering. That happens in Arthur's lifetime. The Druids then fizzle out because of the effects of the Saxons. So it's the end of the Druids. And you get this socking great big volcanic eruption accompanied by meteorite showers and earthquakes all over the planet.
And we're going to leave this planet for a second and we'll be back.
Okay.
Tim, Mark, and Gene, you're in
the Paracast.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNLive.com today.
Do you need a website? Well, you can get a great deal on hosting services with Namecheap's legendary coupon code. They're offering substantial hosting discounts on shared hosting, business hosting, VPS hosting, reseller hosting, and even dedicated servers. Namecheap is preferred by millions. It's backed by a money-back guarantee. Use the coupon code LEGENDARY to cash in on the special deal at Namecheap.com, Namecheap.com.
First came Attack of the Rockoids, and it was a critically acclaimed success. And now there is The Coming of the Protectors. A former military intelligence man is contacted by a space woman in a dream. A dream that turns out to be a nightmare, because evil forces on her distant planet are planning to conquer the Earth. This is gripping science fiction of the classic kind. Attack of the Rockoids and The Coming of the Protectors. Find out more at Rockoids.com. That's Rockoids, Rockoids.com.
Do you ever get the feeling that the world is being held together with duct tape? Every day we're thrown some new meaningless drama in the fake news to distract us from the reality we're all about to face. Between the government trying to print their way out of debt, military conflicts, the disintegration of our most trusted institutions, and a looming food shortage, preparedness is no longer a choice. It's a necessity. You can trust My Patriot Supply. Our emergency food kits come packed with tasty meals, averaging over 2,000 calories per day. Get at least one kit for each person in your family. Self-reliance is the only alternative to government food lines. Time is running out. Become ungovernable. Go to MyPatriotSupply.com and save on dozens of different emergency food kits while you can. These kits are in stock, ship fast, and arrive in unmarked boxes for your privacy. Go to MyPatriotSupply.com before the next crisis strikes. MyPatriotSupply.com.
If you're concerned about the power grid and want to generate your own supply of off-grid electricity, this will be the most important message you'll hear this year. Here's why. We now have a small number of solar generators back in stock. These emergency backup systems provide life-saving backup power when you need it most. And unlike gas generators, solar generators run quietly, emit no dangerous fumes, and produce an endless supply of free electricity from the sun. Whether it's wildfires, dangerous weather, power grid issues, or just getting off the grid, you'll never have to suffer through painful power outages again. Even better, all this week, radio listeners get over $700 in free off-the-grid bonuses, too. Go to MySolarBackup.com to learn more and check availability. That's MySolarBackup.com. Look for the free report, Crisis Cooling, how to make absolutely sure your meat, milk, and medicines stay safe and cool in any power outage. Yours free at MySolarBackup.com.
Wellness and self-care doesn't have to be complicated. So keep it simple and take good care of yourself with Sunny Bay Heating Pads. Our heating pads soothe pains in the neck, back, and shoulders while relaxing muscles and increasing blood circulation. Sunny Bay Heating Pads have always been made in the USA and hand-filled to perfection with the highest quality materials. Sunny Bay Heating Pads are the perfect wellness gift for loved ones or yourself. See all of our high-quality products at sunny-bay.com, including heated body pads, neck pillows, heated neck and body wraps, and our stress-reducing lavender line. They're all affordable, durable, and in stock now and ready for immediate shipping direct from sunny-bay.com. Read our trusted, authentic, and real reviews at sunny-bay.com or just search for Sunny Bay Heating Pad. To your good health and wellness from Sunny Bay.
Hi, this is James Fox, director of The Phenomenon and Moment of Contact. You're listening to The Paracast, the gold standard of paranormal radio.
We are back on planet Earth, I think, Mark. Let us continue.
So there you go. Basically, that's the reason why I think all roads, as it were, lead to Arthur. Because when people look back, there were so many things coming to an end or changing, turning into something else, that were long established, you know, hundreds if not thousands of years. Things were kind of coming to an end. It was the end of the old world. And the last bastion of that old world, certainly in this country, if not in the Western Roman Empire, the last bastion of that was Arthur, potentially in the what was intended originally as the capital of the Western Roman Empire, which is Chester. Of course, the capital of the Eastern was Constantinople, Istanbul. But that survived. That carried on. That grew into the Byzantine Empire. But unfortunately, it didn't survive over here, mainly due to the Saxons and the Danes and the Vikings and invaders. But it's just huge. It's enormous. And it's like you read the book, and as you're reading the book, I'm hoping it'll give people a sense of just how monumental the whole matter of Britain, the whole material that's behind it is. You know, it's a huge change. If people want to look into the catastrophe, by the way, there is a book called Catastrophe, written by a chap called David Keyes, and the science and everything in it are brilliant. You know, it's a bit of a heavy read, but it really shows you exactly what happens. You know, Arthur dies, boom, the world comes to an end. He dies in 539, 542, wham, up goes this enormous volcano. And it's worldwide. It could have been the Leonid meteorite shower that triggered it off, in actual fact. They've subsequently discovered that there's a link to that and to volcanoes going off all over the world, South America, you name it. Even the Aztec Mayan culture was affected by that worldwide movement in the Earth. And it's just, it's you know, earth-shattering. And really, it all comes back, it focuses back on Arthur. So that, if you like, is a thread that runs through the end of Arthur's life. You can't really avoid that because he was very much a person of his time. Back to you guys. Questions are good. I really like the questions tonight. They're really good.
Well, you can see, though, I mean, since a lot of religious beliefs are based on catastrophic events, all right, how people at that time in Great Britain would view, okay, here their great hero has passed away, and then all of a sudden, all, you know, what is breaking loose?
Yeah.
I mean, that had to have been soul-crushing.
Yes, and it was. It's interesting, because looking at the immediate references referring back to the time of Arthur, so, you know, Arthur's gone, the cataclysm's happened, it took them about 80 years to get a structure together in the Old North sufficient to have any kind of rulership or chieftainship. Mm. So you've got at least a lifetime, if not two lifetimes, before they actually get over the chaos. By which time, of course, the place is crawling with Saxons. So, you know, it's a different culture, it's a different world, a different place. There were so many people in Britain that were wiped out. The Saxons were literally sending messages home saying, you know, come and invade the place, it's empty. You know, there's loads of space. You know, just come over here, you know. I don't think it was all bad. I mean, I reckon some of the villages, some of the people needed extra people. So it was kind of a sort of osmosis-type invasion over a period of time, as was the Roman invasion before it. So, you know, the cataclysm, yes, spiritually, they clearly, whatever path they followed, whether it was, you know, Celtic, Druidic, Norse, Christian, whatever, they would have looked to the power, or the powers, as being some kind of a background cause, and what they're suffering is the effect. You know, have we done something wrong? You know, do we need to repent? Whatever. Which might kind of give you an idea what the early Christian medieval approach to life was. You know, the idea of, you know, sins and judgment, and, you know, I mean, you look back at that sort of Hieronymus Bosch type period of, you know, church judgment and that, you could see why they got away with it, because folks were just reeling after what had happened. You know, populations would have just been wiped out. You know, it was a terrible, terrible time, going right through into the 600s. So, yes, you know, I mean, it killed Druidry. It brought Druidry to an end. It completely altered the form of Christianity. It became medieval Christianity, which I now refer to as churchianity. It became that. So many things changed. You know, your politics, your rulership, your social structures. The whole world was a different place afterwards, which then, funnily enough, becomes the world we live in today. So, you know, is the Arthur tale relevant now? Is this book relevant now? Yes, very much so. It's the new foundation for where we are now. You know, the way things were before Arthur is a different world, an entirely different world, literally, to the world we're living in now. We are sort of post-apocalypse, if you like, but most people don't realise the apocalypse occurred, because it occurred in the Dark Ages, and, you know, no tangible human records could be kept for some time thereafter. So it's interesting. That, I mean, that comes up in the book, obviously. It's a major factor in what's going on. And I think I said it to somebody, you know, most people think it's just a book on Arthur, but it's not. There's so much more in that. I think it deserves that title, Polychronicon. I stuck to my guns there, because it's a bit more than, you know, just a fantasy tale about some shiny knight. You know, it's a bit more than that.
All right. We've got a question from one of our listeners, and the listener goes by the name of SRL Plus. And I don't know if you're supposed to say that as a word or just spell it out. So I'll just spell it out and say SRL Plus. And he wants to know, are there any tales of sorcery to be told? Not sorcery, but sorcery. And since the Paracast does do a lot of shows about UFOs and flying saucers, you can expect this kind of question.
Okay, it's another good question. Somebody actually asked me this, I'm sure, before, about, you know, are there any UFOs in the Arthur tales? I'm going to be slightly ambiguous and say unidentified flying objects, or unidentified aerial phenomena, as they're known now, do appear under other titles, other names, in the old tales. So, for example, it's probably not a great example, but it's one. There is a comet. There is an actual comet that occurs in the time of Uther Pendragon, and it is referred to as a celestial dragon. So then the inference there is that dragons can, you know, fly across the sky on fire. That's the inference. But there's nearly always, in that case, because that's why it's in the book, there's some fact
behind what we're seeing as a clearly, you know, fantasized label, as it were. I've not found, I mean, you could say, okay, are there any little green men? Well, if you go to the Irish tales, yeah, fairy folk, they're everywhere, you know. What you've got to do is you've got to look for the cultural equivalent. So I'm not going to say no, there are no flying objects. Nobody specifically lists silver discs flying around. I know they turn up in paintings from sort of the medieval period onwards, but nobody in the Arthurian tales refers to silver discs. But they do refer to a lot of spiritual and visionary things that occur, like, you know, like fairy people, dragons, you know, things like that that can clearly fly, etc. So you just got to sort of dig into and find the equivalent to UFOs. Magic in general, depends on your definition of magic. I rather like the idea that magic is taking what we already have in the world around us and giving it a push, or giving it a shove, so it goes off and does something exceptional. That's what magic is. So people see things, you know, you're not bringing something out of nothing, you're using what's available to create something that is essentially magical. And of course the answer to that is yes, of course that happens. I said it early on, you know, you can imagine Merlin standing on a mountaintop with his staff, you know, going, any minute now I'm going to turn the sun off, you know, boof, the whole thing just goes off. Well, that, to anybody, ordinary man in the street back in, you know, 500 AD, that is going to look pretty awesome. You know, that is going into legend. But Merlin, as an astrologer, would have known when the next eclipse was. So what he's doing is he's giving it a shove, he's giving it a push, he's adding extra meaning, extra value to something that he's doing. If you times that by his vast knowledge of things like herbs, astronomy, astrology, chemistry, what we now refer to as the sciences, and then there's other bits of things he could possibly have been aware of, things like magnetism, light and light lenses, magnification. You know, there's so much technology in the ancient world. You're into sort of ooparts and things like that. You're definitely on von Daniken turf here. There's so much stuff that he would have known of, because he's his druidic network is in contact with the continent. So whatever turns up in Greece, Italy, you know, France, Spain, wherever, even North Africa, he would have been aware of what was out there. And, you know, he would have come up with some amazing things, absolutely incredible things.
We have more incredible things to bring you with Mark and Gene and Tim. You're in
the Paracast.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
Attack of the Rockoids has been well received by critics and readers alike. It's a thrill-a-minute story you'll never forget. A former U.S. military intelligence officer is haunted by intense dreams about a beautiful woman pleading for his help after a terrible battle in outer space. But the dreams turn out to be true and thrust him into a telepathic love affair with a woman whose faraway planet is intent on destroying the Earth. And now the gripping tale continues in The Coming of the Protectors. It's the second book of the Rockoids trilogy, a galaxy-spanning adventure that pits our hapless heroes against powerful, fanatical enemies that threaten the lives of freedom-loving beings everywhere. Attack of the Rockoids and The Coming of the Protectors. Classic science fiction at its best. Available now. For more details, visit Rockoids.com. That's Rockoids.com.
Radio? Why should I advertise on radio? There's nothing to look at, no pictures.
Listen, you can do things on radio you couldn't possibly do on TV.
That'll be the day.
All right, watch this. Okay, people, and now when I give you the cue, I want the 700-foot mountain of whipped cream to roll into Lake Michigan, which has been drained and filled with hot chocolate. Then the Royal Canadian Air Force will fly overhead towing a 10-ton maraschino cherry, which will be dropped into the whipped cream to the cheering of 25,000 extras. All right, cue the mountain. Okay, 25,000 cheering extras. Now, you want to try that on television?
Well...
You see, radio is a very special medium because it stretches the imagination.
Advertising your business with GCN is simple, effective,
and more affordable than you might think.
Visit advertise.gcnlive.com for more info. Take your business to the next level.